Income inequality is a very hot topic right now, and not just because we have a presidential campaign that's putting it front and center. It is truly an issue that gets people where they live, because they live less well if they're on the low end of the inequality. How did we get here, a rich country with so many poor people? Our guest this hour offers some answers in his book, Third Wave Capitalism, How Money, Power, and the Pursuit of Self-Interest Have Imperiled the American Dream. John Ehrenreich is a professor of psychology at SUNY Old Westbury, SUNY being the State University of New York. He's the author or co-author of a couple of previous books, including The Altruistic Imagination. John Ehrenreich, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
So what took you from psychology to the realm of economics and politics and their crossing? And I understand this is not new.
No, actually, psychology was a midlife career change for me, and I've always had an interest in history and social policy issues and in some of the applications of understandings of society to psychology. So it was kind of a marriage of different parts of my career, I suppose.
Let's start with the sense of decline that you agree that many people in America feel, and you point out that in some cases the decline is counter to things that indicate our well-being is actually pretty good.
That's right. You know, I think America is a land of considerable contradictions. We have stagnating wages, and at the same time we have enormous wealth. We have increases in gross national product over the course of the last 30, 40, 50 years, enormous increases, and yet we have poverty that just won't go away. We have a black president, and yet we have increasing anger in the African-American community about structural racism. You know, one can go on and on with that kind of contradictory experience, and that was really what I was trying to make some kind of sense out of.
We covered some of the same ground with Yuval Levin yesterday, and one of his theses is that looking to the past as a guide for where we should be now is perhaps unhelpful. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I think there can be something useful in it as long as we don't get lost in a kind of pointless nostalgia. What's past is past, and we're not going to re-find it easily again. And yet, when I think back to the world of my own childhood, 1950s I'm talking about, I see a variety of changes in America that I don't like. I mean, there are an awful lot of things, awful lot of ways in which America is a much, much, much better place today, despite all of its problems, than it was years ago. Certainly the experience of African Americans and women and gay and lesbian, transgender men and women testify to that, as well as increasing health and increasing educational levels and cleaner air and water and so forth and so on. And yet there are some things that we've lost. I think that we've lost a sense that we can share that we can solve our common problems together. There's much more of a feeling of people being on their own. We have to, you know, if educational problems we're going to solve by sheer grit of students or by better child rearing rather than dealing with the conditions that lead to difficulties in education. And better health will come through our being careful to eat better and not looking at any of the broader social determinants of health and so forth. So I think there's been a real loss of a sense of our power to solve problems collectively. I think there's also been a real loss of a sense of optimism. It's the kind of thing that a Trump is picking up on demagogically without offering any real solutions. But I think that sense of where we're going, I mean, back in my childhood, there was a very clear sense that America was a country in which there had been an unfolding of democracy as well as an unfolding of economic progress. And we feel kind of stopped on that kind of thing. So I think remembering that those things are possible is really, really important. We can't do it by returning to the 50s. You know, if I talk about a sense of commonality, it was a sense of commonality that excluded large numbers of people, black people, Latino people, in many ways women. You know, and I don't think that we want to go back to that. And yet the positive element in it, I think, is something we can aspire to return to. So I think the past is relevant, not as something to be imitated, but as something that we can learn things from.
When you talk about the 50s and 60s, it seems like maybe what we're lacking now is some goals to shoot for. You know, we had the defeat of communism and getting into space and a couple of other goals that we wanted to achieve back then, which we've achieved. And perhaps maybe now the time is to look for other things to shoot for?
Well, I can come up with some pretty easy goals.
Uh-huh.
You know, ending poverty, ending structural racism, a foreign policy that promotes peace rather than engages in reckless wars. I think the goals are, you know, even at a more minute kind of level, making health care accessible to all, making adequate education accessible to all, giving people a sense of job security and of optimism for the future. I mean, those are all easy goals. The issues are how do we get there and how do we get past the political roadblocks to get there.
All right. Much want to talk about political roadblocks. It's a good place to pause for a moment and get our papers out and present them to whoever's standing at that roadblock. John Ehrenreich's book is called Third Wave Capitalism, How Money, Power, and the Pursuit of Self-Interest Have Imperiled the American Dream. So we'll talk about waves 1, 2, and 3 when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with John Ehrenreich and your phone calls and emails in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John Ehrenreich, has written or co-written several books. His latest is called Third Wave Capitalism, How Money, Power, and the Pursuit of Self-Interest Have Imperiled the American Dream. You've been down some of these alleys before, heard it from other people, but John gives us some interesting analysis about the first two waves of capitalism and number three, and how they've affected us and continue to affect us. 800-838-3760. If you have something you'd like to add to the conversation, 800-838-3760, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So let's examine the first two waves of capitalism. Wave one was the industrial wave. Is this the one that got us off the farm and into the factories?
Back in the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution really got things going, and people moved off the farm and into the factories. You had new kinds of technologies that were really very major, the steam engine, of course, above all, which led to steam-powered boats and trains and the like. Newspapers and the telegraph appeared. People were much more in communication with each other and knew much more about what was going on in the world outside their local, wherever they lived. But still, markets were relatively local, and most businesses were fairly small. And the government played an important role in providing subsidies and a legal structure and tariffs and so forth and preserving order, but it wasn't intimately involved in the day-to-day functioning of businesses.
Subsidies like what? I'm curious.
I'm sorry?
Subsidies like what you mentioned?
Well, for example, the Transcontinental Railroad.
Oh, true. Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah, land grants and all that sort of thing, which we're still dealing with.
Land grants, another piece, yeah.
All right. How wrenching were the changes brought by Wave 1? I mean, when you're talking about changing a way of life, getting people from an agrarian to an industrial situation, that's a very wrenching change from the sounds of it.
It's an enormous change. And I think, you know, nowadays people will talk about globalization and about computers and information technology and the Internet, and all that has transformed the world. And no doubt it has, but I think a little perspective is in order. If you think about the railroad and the telegraph, you know, suddenly you could know, you know, people on the East Coast could know what's happening in Oregon instantly. It might not be the 24/7 that we have today, but there was still just an enormous increase in people's awareness and contact with the rest of the world. And in comparison with what had existed for the preceding 10,000 years or so, it was a colossal change, you know, far, far greater than anything we can see happening with the Internet. So, and I think in many other fields, the same thing is true. You know, you think about the clothing we wear. Up until the 1820s or 1830s, it was all woven by hand, which meant it was expensive. And suddenly the possibility of everybody having multiple clothing and being, you know, the poor people can dress in clothes that are very similar to the clothes that rich people dress in, that it's just a transformation of everyday life.
All right, so wave one, industrial. What's wave two, the second wave of capitalism?
Okay, wave two begins somewhere toward the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, and people have called it corporate capitalism or modern capitalism. The big thing that shifts is the emergence of the joint stock corporation, which permits business to operate on a far, far larger scale than before, but also means that the meaning of ownership is more complex. Instead of having one or two people who own some large company, the ownership is distributed among a much larger number, and the number of managers and professionals needed to run it increase dramatically. And with that, you get an increase in the size of markets. You get new forms of communication and transportation and technology. This is, fighting a late season cold.
Okay.
Electricity and chemicals and petrochemicals and steel and automobiles and trucks and telephones and radio and TV appear. The role of the government in here becomes very interesting because, as I said, back in the industrial period, you know, we call this laissez-faire capitalism, the industrial capitalist period, but that's a little bit inaccurate because the government did provide all sorts of subsidies and supports for business. But now when you get into this corporate capitalist period, the government regulates, beginning in the Progressive Era. It intervenes in the economy as a whole to try to fight recessions and fight inflation, and it develops the welfare state. So the government is far more intimately involved in every part of economic life than before. But it's not just involved on behalf of big business, although it often could seem that way, because you had various countervailing forces. You had unions, and you had popular movements of various forms, and advocacy groups, and electoral campaigns. So the government had to respond to the needs of working people and of small businesses and of consumers as well as of big businesses. So that you get a real change in there, and that continues through a good bit of the 20th century.
John Ehrenreich is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Third Wave Capitalism. The union part was one that really stood out to me and does even more so as you talk about it, because it seems like unions at their peak were something like a de facto branch of government within the economy, in the sense that there was a countervailing force to the power of the corporations. And now with the loss of power of unions, it's a little uneven, isn't it?
Very much so. One can exaggerate their power, but certainly their power was not only direct in the workplace and in negotiating with corporations, but the big unions were really the activist base of the Democratic Party from the New Deal on. So back in the days when elections largely meant door-to-door campaigning and get out the vote, just literally driving to people's houses and getting them to the polling place and so forth, it was the big unions that provided the troops for that, which meant that they had an enormous influence. And it was not only unions, though. It was other kinds of groups. If you think about during the 60s, the role of various civil rights groups and later of women's advocacy groups. They represented a real force, and politicians crossed them at their peril. And of course, plenty of politicians did cross them. By no means was it universal to accept their ideas. But they were a real player, and they couldn't be ignored.
So then, John, lay out the third wave of capitalism and its major features.
Okay, so there's another transition that takes place somewhere around the mid-1970s. And, you know, historical transitions are never, things don't turn on a dime. But beginning in the late 60s and on into the early 80s, you see a whole series of different kinds of changes. If you use the same kind of categories I used before, increasingly the economy is dominated by financial services and personal services rather than manufacturing. Markets become global. Companies are not only operating in other countries, but they develop these integrated supply chains. One very striking thing is the rise of the nonprofits. We think of nonprofits as kind of little wishy-washy charitable enterprises, but in fact they make up about 10% of the economy now and include some absolutely enormous operations, Columbia Presbyterian Hospital and Medical School here in New York, if it were on the Fortune 1000 list, would be something like 560 or somewhere around in that area. There are, again, enormous changes in communications, not only high-tech like airplanes, but low-tech like container ships, which make shipping goods around the world much, much cheaper. Certainly computers and biotech and the like. The other thing you get, though, is a real blurring of the public-private distinction. And part of that has to do with the decline of unions and other kinds of movements expressing popular need. That those countervailing things are not there anymore. So you get deregulation, which begins as early as the Carter administration in the late 1970s. You get a huge amount of privatization and outsourcing at the federal government level. Something like one-third of all discretionary spending is now outsourced or privatized. And similar things at state and local levels, everything from prisons to building roads to running transit systems. You get this merry-go-round between public and private sector individuals. The woman who literally drafted the Affordable Care Act, federal legislation, of course, had previously been a vice president at Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield. And she then went on to the White House and did a large part of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And then she went back to Johnson & Johnson, another healthcare industry. And that thing happens all over the place, that kind of back and forth.
A revolving door, as it were.
A revolving door, yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the implications of that is that it leads to a different way that people get rich. That it used to be that people got rich by doing something. Nowadays, increasingly, they get rich by getting a larger share of the benefits from things that are being done anyhow. So they can manipulate laws and regulations and tariffs. And, you know, how does one understand, say, the fact that if you declare bankruptcy, you can get rid of all kinds of debts, Mr. Trump being a great example, right. But you can't get rid of student loans. You know, whose benefit is that to and whose is it not to? It clearly benefits banks, and it's to the detriment of millions and millions of ordinary Americans. And one can give countless examples of the way in which access to power, governmental power and corporate power, permits people to get a bigger and bigger share of what's already being done. You know, back in the 1960s, the average CEO of a corporation earned about 20 or 30 times what the average worker mm-hmm. in their companies earned. Now it's something like 400 times. So that's just a direct transfer of wealth from the people who work in the company to the CEO and similarly to other top management people.
We are talking about John Ehrenreich's book, Third Wave Capitalism, How Money, Power, and the Pursuit of Self-Interest Have Imperiled the American Dream. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, with some observations and stories of your own or some questions for John, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org by email. Here's a call from Scott in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I don't want to contradict anything the guest is saying. It all sounds very plausible, and I agree with it. But there's another aspect of what's happening in the world that I wanted to point out. Now, I could call it maybe a fourth wave of capitalism that I think is very important. I'm not an economist, but it seems to me that one of our basic problems is that in just about everything that's being produced that's affecting the economy, that we have an oversupply problem. The entire world has become so good at making stuff and even providing services that there really is very little growth left. And you see this in the entire Western world. You see it in Japan, and you see it in Europe. And I think it's compounded by two other things. There's this belief, especially in the tech world, that innovation will get us out of this. But the problem is that because of our logistics and the internet, when you invent something, it gets to market and it saturates the market so quickly. Like if you look at iPads and iPhones, iPads came out just a few years ago. They've reached pretty much the saturation point, and the rate at which clones and competition come into the market means that the elevator, you're trying to run up the escalator, but it keeps going down faster and faster, and these product cycles become shorter and shorter. And another aspect of this is that you don't have to buy anything new anymore because of sites like eBay or Craigslist. You can go your entire life and buy a great used car. You never have to buy anything new. And so that, to me, seems to exacerbate or be an underlying cause of many of our problems.
We made so much stuff.
I think that, and even, you know, there's this talk that we need to educate more people. But the reality is that law schools have made too many lawyers. Vet schools have made too many vets, probably architectural schools. I mean, this applies across the board, that there's so much competition and so much oversupply in so many aspects of life that it's hard to see where this is going to end.
All right, let's pick it up and get a response from John. Thanks for that, Scott. Appreciate it.
Okay, I think Scott's making a lot of very interesting points there. Let me just not disagree with him, but throw in a couple of observations. I think the issue about the oversupply problem, you could call it an oversupply problem. You could also call it an under-demand problem. It's certainly true that we have this plethora of new devices, you know, a new iPhone every year and so forth. And yet at the same time, there are millions upon millions of Americans who have to struggle to feed their families. You know, they're not being suffocated by too many goods. They're being suffocated by too little income to buy the most fundamental of goods. I think another way of putting that is that there are real needs that are not being met. And I don't mean only for poor people. You know, when we drive on crumbling roads or worry that a bridge might fall down, or when we have railroads, there was a big train crash near Philadelphia a year or so ago, which could have been prevented with a technology that legally is supposed to be put in, but has been delayed for years and years.
Yeah, they give them a three-year extension to put the
yeah. Yeah. You know, so there's lots of investment in infrastructure and education and healthcare and so forth that can be made, as well as lots of need for material goods that lots of people experience that simply aren't happening. So I think that you're absolutely right that innovation is not the answer to that. We know how to do most of those things. That's not what the issues are. The issues are organizational and their political will and their economic distributional issues.
Well, and the economic distribution part, again, back to what one of the major features is of the third wave, which is this focus on the bottom line for corporations and producing income for the owners, for the shareholders. What I mean, does anything really require a focus on stock prices, or is this just something that came into vogue and then everybody else started doing it because, hey, if GE is doing it, everybody else in the corporate world has to do it?
Well, you said it better than I could. People have talked about the shift from stakeholder capitalism to shareholder capitalism. You know, companies, of course, have always wanted to make money. But if you go back 40 or 50 years, there was some kind of sense that a company had a responsibility to its community. You know, when the big auto companies would lay off workers. And of course, you know, from the perspective of the auto worker, there's the big, cold, greedy auto company laying them off. And yet there was still a notion that when the economy got better again, that they would rehire those guys and those women back, that there was a long-term commitment to them. And there was a shift again somewhere in the beginning, in the late 70s, early 80s, to this much more bottom-line, short-term, the only thing we have to do is make profits for the shareholders. That, you know, that's not written into the law. There's no law that says that the only thing a corporation is allowed to do is to maximize the return to the shareholders, to increase its stock price. It's allowed to do all kinds of things. And that's a decision that was made by corporations, again, and you can trace it pretty clearly, the shift to the late 70s to the mid-late 80s, that happening.
And of course, in the process, though, as they, as you pointed out, the executives get paid better, but they get paid better in stock options now. And so it behooves them and their income to go ahead and make sure that the stock price rises.
Yeah, that's right.
All that stuff going on. John Ehrenreich is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Third Wave Capitalism, How Money, Power, and the Pursuit of Self-Interest Have Imperiled the American Dream. We'll come back and talk more about what the third wave represents, what it has produced in terms of inequality, and some possible remedies for, I don't know, producing a fourth wave, perhaps. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with John Ehrenreich and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the American political system and economy all wrapped up in one. In John Ehrenreich's book, Third Wave Capitalism, How Money, Power, and the Pursuit of Self-Interest Have Imperiled the American Dream. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we go through this. Your questions, comments, and thoughts, welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The third wave, as you point out, John, does come with the triumph of ideology. Which ideology triumphed in this third wave?
Individualistic ideology, basically. I had mentioned that earlier, that there's been a real shift from a notion that we can solve many of our problems that we have in common by common action. Bill Moyers once talked about liberalism as public action for the public good. And that's a notion that's largely disappeared. Instead, we think we solve problems by suing each other or by trying harder or things like that. So there's been an enormous increase in individualism, but not individualism. And individualism has a very positive element to it, but it can also have a very selfish, narcissistic element to it. And I think that's what's triumphed. And we've been told that that's all that's possible, that people keep repeating that Reagan line about government being the problem, not the solution, and things like that. And, as they say, government is the problem until you need it. That we can do a lot of things in common, and we have to learn how to do those at local levels and at state levels and at community levels as well as at national levels.
Where to start to rebuild, though, because it seems like the fact that people rarely use the word liberalism anymore is probably a sign of liberalism's defeat.
Well, I think it is a sign of liberalism's defeat. People come up with other words. I guess progressivism has been a modern version of it, and one of the efforts on the part of conservatives has been to tar the very names that liberals or progressives give themselves as being somehow suspect, that if you're a liberal, that that's a bad thing. Well, if a liberal means that you take care of your neighbors, I'm not quite sure why it's a bad thing.
So the free market ideology and its proponents, did they ever accept blame as well as credit for the way the system has changed?
Not really. I think that there seems to be a long history of every time things don't work out really well, people on the right come up with some explanation or they just repeat the old predictions all over again.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking of George Will and joining the flock of people who blame Fannie and Freddie for the mortgage implosion.
Right, right. Well, that's a good example. Here you have a crisis that was produced by the selfishness of private interests, aided and abetted by the blind eye or even the assistance turned by government regulators, and then somehow the blame becomes the government, not the private interests that made those loans.
Let us take some more calls here. Here's Ryan in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Ehrenreich.
Well, gosh, again, thank you. This is such an awesome conversation. I was driving and I had to pull over.
I appreciate you getting off the road.
No problem. Me too. I'm just thinking back to that me generation and, the rise of corporatism and cocaine and all of the rest of the stuff. I lived through the 80s, and not that I participated in that. But, we've really suffered from this for, 30 some odd years. And I want to have a positive attitude. So
you know, how do we replace that individualism with communitarianism? You know, how do we do that? Because that's really the nugget, the fourth wave.
All right.
It's about individuals, the sweet spot between individualism and individual initiative and motivation and all of those things, but understanding that our community, you know, is the tide that, you know, floats all boats. So how do we do that?
All right. Good question. Thanks for that, Ryan. Appreciate it.
Wish I had an easy answer for you. No, I think you're putting your finger on a really serious kind of issue. How do we restore that sense that we can do some things together? And I think that just as we lost it by losing it, we regain it by regaining it. It's sort of one step at a time. One of the things that's very evident in American history is that progressive social change has come when millions of people demand it. It doesn't come simply by the goodwill of politicians who make nice promises. That if those politicians don't have massive energy behind them, and by massive energy, I mean the energy of masses of people, nothing much happens. And so, you know, the progressive era was a period of the populist movement and of the rise of the Socialist Party and of some huge strikes, and you get progressive regulation. And the New Deal was a period, again, of massive labor unrest, and you got progressive legislation. And the 1960s were a period of the civil rights movement and of unrest in the cities and of the rise of the women's movement and the student movement, the environmental movement, and you got legislation. And it's a kind of a self-reinforcing thing. When people experience that there is a response to their collective endeavors, it encourages them to act in those collective ways. So I think that the simplest answer I can give is that I feel very, very supportive of collective efforts to solve problems. And, you know, those are often messy and not very pleasant and get on people's nerves, whether it's Black Lives Matter or Occupy Wall Street or the opt-out from the Common Core testing movement or things of that sort, the Fight for 15 movement. They can be noisy and disruptive and so forth, but they do gradually both produce the idea that we can work together for change and reinforce the kind of personality patterns that say we're in this together.
One of the defining characteristics you list of third wave capitalism is rent seeking. Can you explain that concept?
Yeah, this is what I didn't use the term before, but I was talking about it a little bit earlier. The idea is that how do people get rich? How do people accumulate wealth? Do they accumulate it by doing something new, by producing something different? Or do they do it by virtue of their power to grab a larger share of what's already being done? So let me give an example, and it's in some ways an unfair example, but it's one I like. Bill Gates, the richest man in the country. Why is he the richest man in the country? Is it because he's the greatest computer programmer that ever lived? No. By most accounts, he was okay, but nothing all that special. Is it because he's the sharpest businessman that ever lived? No. Again, Microsoft functioned competently, but not any more so than lots of other things. What happened is he managed to get a monopoly on the operating system for personal computers. And so every single computer that everybody bought, well, not the Apples, but every other computer that anybody bought for 30 years had Windows and Internet Explorer built into it. So the result is effectively, you know, every man, woman, and child in the United States gave Bill Gates a couple hundred dollars. And that's where his fortune is from. It's from being in that position where you could get that to happen rather than producing something that was so clearly better than anything anybody else did.
Oh, so in a sense, the people always have to come back and pay him rent for using his thing. Got it.
Exactly.
There's a government component in rent seeking, though, often, isn't there, where people are seeking the government to pay them for their stuff?
Absolutely. You know, anything ranging from legal structures that benefit certain corporations, subsidies, crop subsidies, for example. Think about the drug industry. Drug industry, an enormously profitable industry. What's the core of the research that goes into the drug industry? It's provided by the taxpayers. So you and I pay taxes, and folks at some university or medical school do research, and law was passed about 30 years ago permitting the university to patent the results of that research. So the university patents it. They then license it to a drug company. The drug company does a little bit more work on it, not all that much, very frequently. And then they start selling it at a profit. Who do they sell it to? Well, they sell it back to doctors and to individuals and to hospitals, largely paid for by Medicare and Medicaid. Incidentally, the research that the drug companies do on it, of course, is tax deductible. And the bottom line is that they make billions of dollars on it. So at every step along that process, the structure of government has assisted them, whether it's in the tax structure or the subsidies for research or the legal structure that permits that tax-supported research to be used to make private profits. All that transfers money to the drug companies.
So in that particular example, and many others too, you can see here that the people who are asking for light regulation, government not to get in their way, also depend upon government to make them rich.
Of course. Of course. It's government, get out of my way, except help me, please, and don't let anybody know you're helping me.
Huh. You do mention Citizens United in this part of the book. How big an obstacle is that to changing the system?
Well, certainly the issues in making our country more democratic are very, very great. Let me back away from Citizens United for a second, and I'll come back to it. But if you look at the U.S. Congress, let us say, which has been controlled by the Republicans for the last several congressional sessions, and yet if you look at the popular vote for Congress, the Democrats win it. And that's a combination of a bunch of different things. It's a bunch of, it has to do with gerrymandering. It has to do with a structure that gives unequal representation, more representation to rural districts and rural states than to urban districts. It's also things like it's restrictions on the right to vote, efforts to make it harder for people to vote, which inevitably affects poor people more than richer people. And then it's also things like the financing, the astronomical amount of funds that go into running a modern campaign, which not only means that that the outcome of elections may be determined by the availability of the money, but that individual representatives, this is true, incidentally, state and local as well as national, but especially at the national level, that from the perspective of people running for those offices, that being on the good side of the funders becomes ever more essential, which means that they're more likely to do the things that help those guys who have money make still more money.
So here again, it's sort of a parallel to the corporations. When you're not concerned with all the stakeholders, you're concerned most with the shareholders, and the shareholders are the ones that put the most money in.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's take a call from Russell in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Ehrenreich, the author of Third Wave Capitalism.
Good morning.
Hi.
I want to ask your guest, how to comment on our ability to produce. I saw something in Northeast China last year, just a visit up there. I just took a little detour into a factory that was walled off, and trucks were coming in and depositing recycling material. There was a large factory in the center, and all around the perimeter were recyclers. They do iron, the next one steel, next one alloy, then aluminum, and so on, all around this factory. The trucks were coming in with all these goods we maybe just throw away.
Okay, I need to get to a question because of our time here.
Right, and and then these big trucks were coming out of the main door with brand new stuff, and the place just hummed with efficiency. And I was so impressed, I thought, God, we'll never catch up.
All right, there's the question there. So how, I mean, are we keeping up? Are we as efficient as the rest of the world? Is our productivity as workers good?
Well, productivity is a complicated thing, and what productivity even means, I think, has become more complicated with globalization. You get something. I heard a report the other day that the power button on an iPhone the various bits and pieces of it travel something like 50,000 miles before they end up in the Apple store, from the raw materials through the production and so forth. There are parts of that that are highly efficient. I mean, they operate because it's cheaper to do it that way than to assemble everything in one place. Let me give a crazy example. Fish gets caught in the Pacific Ocean off Alaska and off of Oregon and Washington, and it gets frozen, and it gets shipped off to China, and it gets thawed out in China where it gets processed, and then it gets refrozen and shipped back to the United States to be sold. And that's because the combination of wages and shipping costs are so low. But that doesn't make sense. It's efficiency at the sense of some rational organization of the economy.
Well, it's globalization, certainly, and that is part of the issue of third-wave capitalism. That is the title of John Ehrenreich's book, subtitled How Money, Power, and the Pursuit of Self-Interest Have Imperiled the American Dream. John, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thanks, Jeff. It's been a pleasure talking with you, folks.
All right. Take care.